So I'm Dr. Scott Morris with Church Health, and I am joined today, as every month, with Joy Marseille, Joshua Narcissa, Rabbi Micah Greenstein, and the one and only Kirk Qualam, and you are listening to The Mystic.
Good morning, and thank you again for joining us and awakening to the mystic with Maestro Kirk Qualam and friends. I am Rabbi Micah Greenstein of Temple Israel, coming to you live from the Green Room at Crosstown Concourse with the Reverend Dr. Scott Morris, founder and visionary of Church Health, an amazing next-gen pastor, Reverend, both at Mississippi Boulevard and Church Health, Joshua Narciss, and one who was just named top 20 Memphians under age 30, although for us she's top five, that would be Joy Marseille of Crosstown Arts, where there's plenty of room to breathe. And we're also honored not only to have Kirk Qualam, but Johnny Panetta. So what is this conversation all about? We hope, eyes open or closed, wherever you are, you will think about this hour as a moment of meaningful conversation. Imagine you're sitting in a living room with leaders across all lines, racial, religious, geographic, talking about the issues that really matter in life, where we are right now at this moment in time. Let your spirit soar. Let your soul roll into the mystic.
Again, welcome to The Mystic. I'm very excited to have you all. Last month we met on, I believe, January 4th, I want to say, just 2 days before the incidents at the Capitol. And unbeknownst to us, it was quite a month.
History was about to change.
Right? History was about to change. We had no idea. And it was an excellent conversation that we had. But we're definitely going to be shifting into kind of a different realm of conversation in this one. On January 6th, I think we can honestly all say that white supremacy was at play and in full force in those moments. Obviously, there's not a way to homogenize every single person who was involved in those protests and riots. But seeing a Confederate flag flying in the Capitol for the first time in history, I know for me as a Black woman, was impactful. And so today we're going to have a conversation about white supremacy, about whiteness, and about how these elements can kind of affect us personally, but definitely have affected each of us in our faith groups that we all belong to. Unfortunately, white supremacy is a beast with many heads. It does not stick to just one thing. It's defined as the belief that white people can constitute a superior race and should therefore dominate society, typically to the exclusion or detriment of other racial and ethnic groups. But in that, it also really gets into what I think it's transformed into, which is white hegemony, which is around the preponderant influence or authority over others and the social, cultural, ideological, or economic influence exerted by a dominant group. Basically, this idea that whiteness is rightness, that whiteness is the expectation, and anything that falls outside of that is other. And that has lots of different iterations. We've seen it lots of different ways. But I want to think about how specifically white supremacy and white hegemony has infiltrated religion. It certainly has had a huge impact on nearly every major religion, I would say every major religion, either through exclusion, maybe exemption of facts, or changing of facts, or through very clear and overt oppression. So I want to talk about that a little bit. I think the easiest way to start the conversation, unfortunately, is with American Christianity. Honestly, because of the foundations of American Christianity, it's very difficult to extricate it from white supremacy and from whiteness. And so as a Black minister, I'm interested in your thought on this, Joshua.
Where to start?
Right.
We know, particularly when it comes to American Christianity, that whiteness and Christianity on this land have always been intermingled, right? Whether you think about the landing of or the arrival of enslaved bodies, or rather the first Africans who will later end up enslaved in 1619, and the kind of missional motivations that propelled the English settlers in what they were doing, not only in settling the land, but also in co-opting these bodies and that labor. The seeds begin there, right? And heck, even before there, but on this land, let's say it starts 1619, and we continue to see these two strands of religion emerging, because there are some that will say that, well, I will say that Black religion is its own, Black religious praxis when it comes to Christianity is its own kind of stream that is influenced by, in conversation with, in rebellion against white Christianity, to the point where we know that the churches or the worship services that enslaved peoples tried to hone for themselves were always under the watchful gaze of the slave master. But the real kind of religious encounters were happening in the brush harbors, out of sight. And so there's always been this conversation and this conflict when it comes to how religion was going to live out in America alongside or living alongside whiteness. And when I think about the power of whiteness to assume and dominate everything and how it will twist and contort itself in order to remain powerful, it's astonishing. I remember, and now I'm getting long-winded, so I think I'll end with this little motif. I was on Instagram, like most folks, over the weekend or last weekend, and I remember seeing a clip, and it was posted on like one of those kind of like church laugh accounts, and it was a pastor, and she was, she was preaching, you know, Jesus loves the United States. And, you know, Jesus loves the red, white, and blue. And, you know, that red, white, and that blue, it means something. You see those stripes. What do you think those stripes mean? By his stripes, we are healed. And just the absurdity, right, of how whiteness in the desire or in the quest for power will make Jesus a white nationalist, will make Jesus a capitalist, will make Jesus completely fine and supportive of slavery and coerced labor, and all the ways and all the things it will do in order to maintain power and influence. And I'll leave it there because I feel like I'm saying too much.
No, I mean, I think you made some excellent points. I think that some of the difficulty around white nationalism, white supremacy, white hegemony, all of these, this larger scale idea of whiteness is rooted in contortion. It's rooted in kind of a mythology of excellence or superiority based off of, I mean, literal pigment in the skin, right? Often difficult to even root to a particular space or region. When I think about the contortions of white supremacy, I mean, it's impossible to talk about white supremacy and not talk about the Holocaust and not talk about the oppression of Jewish folks in America, but in the world. And obviously, just by definition, white supremacy has oppressive effects. But I'm also interested in what your thoughts are, Rabbi, about how white supremacy and the Jewish faith have both obviously collided in horrible and in devastating ways, but also how they sometimes are intermingled in strange ways as well.
Thanks, Joy. This whole idea of seeing other people and the world through the lens of race is such a new phenomenon in human history. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Holocaust. The big lie about the Holocaust was a continuation of this, as you said, mythology, this social construct that the 1% that divides us phenotypically is what defines us. And what the Nazis did was convince the world that Jews are a race, a vermin that needs to be extinguished. And that was not long after some of these scientists in the 19th century invented words that I feel guilty about checking off in a box. The word Caucasian.
Right.
Came from some whacked out scientist who had no training like a Scott Morris and who just defined humanity in terms of four races that he made up. And he made up the one, the Caucasus Mountains, because they were white. And he said that was the best one. And ever since, the whole phenomenon of defining in terms of race. So for us as Jews, I think, and for you as Christians, or even if someone doesn't even practice a religion, a Buddhist who believes in compassion, this idea of defining people in terms of the color of their skin is the last couple hundred years of bunk science. Yeah. That is serious business because it's resulted in the annihilation and murder and racing. I see race as a verb, it's not a noun.
Yeah.
And just finally, you know, I get chills thinking here at Crosstown Concourse where you had the race riot of 1860, right after Reconstruction, 1866, where you had 46 African Americans killed and dozens of women raped, and it led to the passage of the amendment which enabled blacks to be citizens. And people don't ask, like, who killed them? And if you look, it doesn't say white people. It says the Celtic race, Irish, did not come here as white. Mm-hmm. They came right. here as Celtic.
Yeah.
Right.
Jews came here as like Oriental immigrants.
Right.
And it's what Brother Joshua said. It's become this construct that has sadly defined American religion mm-hmm. and twisted it and contorted it, like you said, for the most unholy ends. Yeah. So I always wonder, like, when did people become white when they immigrated here?
Yeah.
And it's when they were, I think, galvanized to commit oppression against blacks. Mm. Whether, I think that bears out historically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Not all, I don't want to make a categorical statement, I'll be quiet. But my point is that race is a verb, it's not a noun.
Yeah.
I even want to tack on to that if I could, right? Like, when we think about whiteness in this country, I'm locating it in white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, right? Protestantism as a religious practice and as quote-unquote white Caucasians at the founding of the country, right? And those who are pissed off and are leaving England for religious freedom, right? The myth that we tell ourselves. And once we get to a point where white Protestants the majority is slipping, mm-hmm. first they start, when I think of Protestants versus Catholics, right? First they start to attack Catholics as Romanists right. and folks who can't be trusted because they're controlled by the Pope. And then all of a sudden, well, let's not attack them, let's co-opt them, let's bring them in. Because we have to maintain that majority. We have to maintain that power. We have to maintain that control. And so now we galvanize them to join in on the oppression of the other folks that can't be white because we've based it in skin tone, right?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, perfectly said. I think, I mean, all we're talking about, too, I really encourage listeners to look up who Carl Linnaeus is. He was the taxonomer. I don't know.
Spell his last name.
L-I-N-N-E-U-S, I believe. Linnaeus. There may be an A in there. But Carl Linnaeus, and he's the father of taxonomy and categorized like plants and animals and all these kinds of things. But he is who determined what was Caucasian and mm-hmm. all these different terms around race that were essentially made up. I mean, he had no physical contact with most of these other groups. Mm-hmm. He was only with other white folks or people who he would now describe as white. And so it was completely made up. And I think, I mean, it's exactly what both of you all are speaking on is that, it really is a mythology and it's something, whiteness, and I think this is true for other races as well, though there is some historical context and culture when you think about other racial groups or whatever, but that have been really forced into existence because of this pervasive push for whiteness and whatever that means. Scott, I'm really interested in what you have to say around this. I, as a white man who is from the older generation than me, I know I experience... there are many of my peers who I think could talk about whiteness in a way that is clear. Was that something that you ever had to define? And if so, how would you define that now?
So in thinking about the Catholic component here, I am old enough. I wish you hadn't brought that up. But
sorry.
I'm old enough to not actually know how to do Instagram, Joshua. But also remember when Kennedy was running for president,
right?
And the fact that he was Catholic made a difference. Now, I mean, did anybody even bring it up that Biden was Catholic? Do you remember hearing any conversation about Biden being Catholic? But Kennedy running for president in 1960, it was a big deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, they brought
it's like
it up,
the Pope was going to run America.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, anyway, to you, y'all, it is just, I feel this issue of white privilege a lot at some level, but I also know that I've been protected my entire life from just a lot of stuff that the four of y'all, even Micah, have had to deal with by being a Jew. And it's like it doesn't impact me on a daily basis really at any level whatsoever. And it never did. But when I was, you know, 6 years old, these things,
yeah,
nobody had to have a conversation with me over the fact that I was white, right. You know, or what might happen because you're white, you got to be careful,
right.
Or this conversation that, you know, black young men have with their father. I mean, nobody sat me down and had a conversation of the consequences of being a white male.
Yeah. Right.
That, I mean, so there's, and I think even so many of our friends who I hope are still watching, listening today, I can just see them rolling their eyes going, why are they talking about this one more time? You know, I mean, I know y'all feel it, but I mean, I feel it as well among my own friends about how they just want to move on.
Yeah, let's not talk about this anymore.
Let's not talk about this anymore. Yeah. Let's just move on. And I think there's an element we would all like to move on, just like we would like to move on from the virus. But we can't just move on from the virus, right?
Right,
we can't
just
wish away the fact that the virus is with us. Neither can we wish away the fact that these issues are real. And I guess we're all trying to be too long-winded here. But, you know, the whole thing about what happened in the Capitol, well, that wasn't me. I don't have a single friend who would say that was me. Those people are all other, without realizing that there's an element of, in America, being white made you be a part of it, whether you felt like you should be, you know, criticizing it or not. I mean, in fact, that you said it was the first time the Confederate flag was ever in the Capitol. I was going, really?
Ever.
Not even during the Civil War.
Not even during the Civil War.
Real, that's amazing, right? Right? Unbelievable.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. I think this is a great time to take a moment to hear some soothing tones from Kirk Whalum. I think a lot of the time when we think about race in this country, it can feel so polarizing. It can feel so attacking, right? That now I'm not just Joy. I have to be Black Joy, right? You're not just Dr. Morris. Now you're White Dr. Morris, right? And we have to talk about this in such a painful and frustrating way. But exactly what you spoke to around we want to distance ourselves from these kinds of events, you know? But exactly what you said, that whiteness as a ideology is what perpetuates this. The same thing that flew the Confederate flag in the Capitol is the same whiteness and the same power that, you know, convinces somebody to, you know, walk in front of me in a grocery store even though I was walking there first. You know, it seems very small, but it's these tiny little things that really have these much broader effects than we can imagine.
Your land, this line is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. Yes, I was wrong in the river, born. I saw it all. The endless sky, I saw below me the golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps. red diamond desert, and all around me a voice was sounding in. This land was made for you and me.
When the sun came shining, I was strolling, and the wheat field waving, and the dust clouds rolling. As the fog was lifting, I heard a voice chanting. He said, you know, this land was made for both of us.
So when Woody Guthrie wrote that, was he thinking about white privilege?
Well, apparently.
I mean, do you know some of the history there? I don't
well, I don't know the specific history of that song, but I do know that Woody Guthrie was Trey woke. Woody Guthrie was absolutely plugged in to the struggle of black people and the people of color, of non-white people in this country. And it's just, you look back and you appreciate those courageous folks, man.
Yeah.
Who were white and who were all colors, who stood in solidarity, in courageous solidarity with the struggle to their in existential, you know, trauma and sort of, you know, danger. Yeah. You know, I mean, they suffered reputational harm and they suffered physical harm.
Yeah.
And apparently that wasn't enough to shake them off, you know, and it just, I think, you know, we thought about, you know, Johnny and I, bringing that song and the next we're going to do, we sort of snatch them out of the 60s, and because it's the same struggle. You know, and I think one of the things that you've brought up, you know, that was such a revelation to me when I started really, really reading about this whole thing of white supremacy and its connection to the church and to religion, and in particular to white evangelicalism or Protestantism in this country, is that white wasn't a thing, you know, right. Like it was just not a thing. Like, you know, when this whole experiment got started, you were in just as much peril, like we said, for being Italian, you know, or Irish or Polish, or, you know, as you were for being black. I mean, it's like in a sense, the fact, and that word that I looked up and I've now forgotten it,
phenotype.
Phenotype.
Phenotypical. That's a very hip word. You know, all of that factors into what we're seeing here. But I want to at least mention the fact that, you know, I'm sitting here with people who are very well-read, and I think that's, you know, that's a part of where we are that is a part of the problem, is that people are not willing to read. And I think, you know, there's this sort of elitism, this anti-elitism, where we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, like, you know what, you're so smart, you know, you think you're smarter than everybody, Okay, but see, as far as I'm concerned, like when I was learning French initially and then Spanish, I read children's books.
Yeah.
And so the point is that the information is available on a very, very childlike, with the level I'm trying to think, you know, like, how do I say, you know, like, it's not about being brilliant. It's about being willing to open your mind and to learn from history, ask people. But the reading, is, as they say, is fundamental. I want to bring out two books that, you know, since this is on the air, maybe someone would benefit from this. I truly benefited from these particular two books. One is called White Too Long. It's by Robert Jones, and it specifically deals with this topic. It specifically deals with the connection between racism, white supremacy in particular, and the Christian church.
Yeah.
Because they are knit together, and they have been knit together since day one. Okay, White Too Long. And it's a super book, and the guy was a former, I'll say it like you say it down here in the South, Southern Baptist. That's B-A-B-D-I-S-T. And then the other one is The Color of Christ. And this is more about iconography. This one is more about, you know, how Christ has been presented. Like, you know, we just zero, you know, if we could just focus in on just the person of Christ, like the Messiah in this, you know, American Protestant setting was a white dude. And that was not a problem.
Right.
And so now we look back and we say, yes, that was absolutely a problem. And it is at the root, hypothetically, of a lot of the stuff that we saw on January 6th. By the way, you're listening to and hopefully enjoying Into the Mystic with Rabbi Micah Greenstein, Joshua Narcisse, Joy Marseille. I'm Kirk Whalum and the inimitable Scott Morris. And our special guest musician is Johnny Pineda.
Yeah.
May I just throw in one more book?
Yeah.
It's A History of White People by Nell Painter of Princeton. That's what rocked my world. I'm not an expert on this, but that's how I learned about Linnaeus and the root of Caucasian. And you're right. You're right, Kirk, about the bravery of the Guthries of that era. But what really saddens me, and I hope saddens our listeners, is the cowardice of today. It's like we listen to the great music you and Johnny just played. I listen to it as a call to action, but I think, you know, talk about the big lie about the election. What about the big truth of when you see a hat that says "Make America Great Again" outside a church? The question to ask isn't about a candidate. But it's, when are you talking about 1954 before Brown versus Board of Education? When do you want to go back? Do you want to go back to the end of the 50s when Rosa Parks, you know, started the? So and if you want to get biblical, if you really want to talk about race, then look at the Psalm of Songs, if Song of Solomon, whatever you call in your tradition. Listeners, look up the Song of Songs where it says, Shchora ani v'navaz, the original Hebrew. I am black-skinned and beautiful. Now, I'm not honing in on it, but if you want to talk about real color, instead of these crazy evangelical justifications for slavery, talking about Ham and theories about that, but if you want to talk about black, Moses' wife was black. And it says, I am black-skinned and beautiful. But we don't, why do we even have to talk about that? I just am crying over the cowardice to call the question of when are you talking about? When was great? And I'm as moved as anyone by the music, don't get me wrong, but I wish we were as brave. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Hey, spell the name of the author of History of White People.
I believe it's Nell Painter, P-A-I-N-T-E-R.
Got it.
She's at Princeton, A History of White People.
Thank you.
awesome.
Or the history of white people.
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about is white hegemony, right? Like, so white supremacy is a scary word. It's like, like, I'm not a Nazi. That's like where people will go, right? But white hegemony is really what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're talking about this normalization of whiteness as the norm, like that, not just the norm, but the expectation that Jesus was good and was holy, so he must be white, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know,
Swedish.
Right, he must be Swedish. you know, that, I mean, you could, I mean, pick a season, pick a person, but that there is an expectation that if something is good, it must be white.
Well, I remember seeing the first painting I ever had of like a black Jesus. Mm. And it was startling.
Yeah.
So, you know, probably when I'm a teenager, you know, in the 60s or something, but you see a picture of Jesus painted and he's black and it's like, well, why'd somebody's just that? Trying to make a point, you know, because that can't possibly. I mean, it's just not how you right. were taught. Because
When I taught at Memphis Theological Seminary, Kirk was there, and John Kilzer, may rest in peace. And I always used to say, imagine that in Israel, the archaeologist discovered a picture of Jesus from the first century. Forget about white, black, but he looked like my short, balding Jewish grandfather. Would that not change the way you envision God when you close your eyes? We're so conditioned visually by the blonde-haired guy.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
And by the way, that goes around the table. You know, Joshua and Joy can both probably attest to growing up, I know I can, with in a black church with a white Jesus right behind the pulpit. I mean, and I'm talking about 95%, if not more, of the black churches mm-hmm. had this white long-haired Jesus. Mm-hmm. And again, mm-hmm. they deal with that in this book, The Color of Christ. It's a fascinating book. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the joke. I mean, I guess it's kind of a joke where, like, what are the pictures that every black grandmama has in her house? Mm-hmm. She has a picture of Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on how it goes, she has a picture of JFK.
Yep. Yep.
Now she'll have a picture of Obama.
Of Obama. Yeah.
And then a picture of white Jesus. Right?
Yeah.
And his picture was bigger.
His picture was the right. biggest one. And you don't mess with that picture of white Jesus. I'm thinking, of course, I wasn't around when it was in syndication. I'm thinking of Good Times.
Mm.
And that episode where the mother, Florida Evans, has this picture of white Jesus, and she's confronted with this picture of black Jesus with the fro. Sidebar, personally, my favorite depiction of Jesus is the one with the locks and the six-pack with the broken chains. It looks like he'll put up 40 on the court.
Yeah.
But he has but she's holding on to this picture of white Jesus. She doesn't want to confront this idea that Christ could not be white, that Christ could deviate from this portraiture, this depiction of what she is used to and what she has accepted. And eventually she resolves it and she accepts, she displays the picture of black Jesus, but it's this visceral reaction that there's no way on earth Jesus cannot be blonde-haired, blue-eyed, serene, looking off into the distance. The idea that Christ could be associated with something that we've made too radical, too unintelligent, too bad, too criminal.
Mm-hmm.
It's even as, right, he's crucified and executed by the state as a criminal, right?
Right.
It's a cognitive dissonance.
You gotta promise me to get that book, man, The Color of Christ. It's just fascinating. Yeah. It's fascinating.
Cognitive dissonance is exactly what it is. That, and I mean, it's throughout our whole conversation and around anyone's conversation around whiteness. The problem is that if you have to accept that maybe Jesus isn't white, then you have to accept some other things, right? Maybe if that's not right, then what else is not true, right? That if my understanding, if I am associated somehow with those folks who are in the Capitol, then what else must be true about me, right? We talk about folks going back, like, I'm the descendant of slaves, but somebody's a descendant of slave masters. You know what I'm saying? So there's like, there's this cognitive dissonance that we're all kind of working through as human beings. Like, we don't like to deal with two conflicting realities. Cognitive dissonance really refers to holding two potentially opposing beliefs at one time, right? So I believe that I'm strong, but I think it's not strong to cry, so then therefore I don't cry, mm-hmm. right? That's the solution we create for ourselves. And it's difficult to live in cognitive dissonance, but the reality is, especially when we're talking about race in America, especially when we're talking about religion in America, you cannot have these conversations without grappling with cognitive dissonance, mm-hmm. And with grappling with the pain of history and the pain of mistold histories. It sounds like those two books, actually all these three books, kind of deals with some of the pain of mistold histories, right? That there's a little bit different. Can you imagine what it would be like growing up in a white church and there's always a black Jesus, right? Like, can you imagine how that would shift your thought process about black people? That would shift your thought process about brown people, maybe, right? That, which in reality, Jesus was most likely brown. But right, he's Middle East, right? Brown skinned. So in all of that, like when we're thinking about normalizing something else, right? Today, when we're recording, is the first day of Black History Month, and Black History Month is again falling into similar patterns of white hegemony, because what do we need a month for if we're just teaching American history, right? If we're just teaching American history truthfully, then blackness should be in there, right? Black folks should be in there as a part of the history. But in this first day of the month, I think it's still really important for us to specifically engage cultures that are outside of the quote-unquote norm, you know?
Yeah. I was just curious.
Yeah.
Because you did the research for today, since it's Black History Month. Might it be that Black History Month is a reaction to white hegemony saying that black people really are inferior, and then a black historian saying, but we got Frederick Douglass, like, listen, you're really okay.
Yeah.
In some ways, this whole month is a reaction to that, is it not?
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I'm just asking the question that when you're a victim and you begin to believe the rapist that you just dressed funny.
Right.
By the way,
being called boy, girl at age 50, being told that you're dirty.
Right.
The trauma that has to be undone. I'm just wondering, you know, who Black History Month is for. Like, I like it to be for white people to understand. But
So it was actually started in 1926 and was Negro History Month.
Originally.
I mean, I don't know that much about it other than that. But
I mean, there is the origins of what we now call Black History Month are, in a sense, responding to the idea that we have no history. That we are a historyless people, and that our story is only matters when it's told in relation to and under the shadow of and under the gaze of the American story, which has been a white story,
right?
And so it's a way of saying we want to tell the whole story. We want to tell the truth, and the truth is we've always been a determinative part of this country,
right?
Yeah, look, I can tell you, again, growing up in the 60s, thinking about history in elementary or even in high school, I mean, George Washington Carver, that was pretty much it. Mm. I mean, I don't think I learned about any black person.
Hank Aaron, you're an Atlanta guy.
And, you know—
That was current history. That wasn't—
I think it's important for Joy's topic for us to include the fact that, yes, whiteness is suspect and has always been. Like, what is that? And then the fact that the Protestant white American church has always been the primary purveyor of the madness, mm-hmm. and that it has always included violence. It has always included violence. What happened on January 6th is absolutely connected to what has always been the reaction of that faction.
Yeah. Yeah, very well said. Sorry, I got lost in thought for a moment. that's exactly it. And I think it's not an excuse when we think about, in fact, it should compel all of us to think more deeply about the realities. I mean, when we look at, sometimes we look at, pictures of Martin Luther King, or we look at, pictures of school integrations, and we see this background of white people, most expressively white women, right? I mean, screaming at the top of their lungs, yelling, screaming, and stuff like that. And most of those people are still alive. Mm-hmm. Like, that is not, they are not too old to be, mm-hmm. to remember it or to engage it or to be honest about it. So when you flip the script a little bit and bring it into January 6th, 2021, I'll tell you, I think most people of color were not shocked by the scene, because it's the scene that's in the background of every historical landmark of our experience, right? Mm-hmm. As Black people in particular, that if there is progress being made in some direction, just like when Obama was elected and there was progress being made in that way, there's always a reactionary, visceral, aggressive response, usually, almost always actually, I mean, completely intertwined with violence.
I know we got to go to music. I'm just curious what these four pastors and you, Joy, think about the idea when you just mentioned those angry, yelling white women who probably went to church on Sunday.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad definitely. You brought that
and,
up.
And like when I see the Nazi Nuremberg trials of these henchmen who threw babies' heads against walls and then had mass before they were sentenced to death.
Right.
What do you all think about the fact that religion hasn't been able to stop this?
Right, so let me just bring the end to the discussion that the fact that it was absolutely not unusual at all. It happened a lot. And that is that right after Sunday service, they would have a lynching.
Therefore, what does that say about the strength of religion to stop this?
I would argue that religion actually is a complicit. I think it's a big part of it. I think it's complicit is not even the right word. Like a co-conspirator with the violence that we see. Obviously, I'm not talking about every individual person, but religion. When we go back in Christianity's roots, right, that when you go back to the Crusades, I mean, there is a prevalence of violence associated, deeply associated with religions of all breeds, to be honest, but especially in Christian religions, that violence is almost part and parcel, which is, to me, very confusing when you think about the legacy that is trying to be taught, right, around peace and around...
Love one another.
Love one another and things like that. Love one another or I'll bust your head. Like, you know...
I'm not trying to bash religion. I think there's good religion and bad religion, but it's not strong enough to stop this, it seems, at moments in history.
Well, religion versus faith, right?
Micah introduced me to one of the best books I've ever read, James Carroll's The Constantine Sword, which is, I mean, the first time I read Constantine's Sword, it just made me sick unto death to think that this religion that I am committed to no end and the violence, to your point, Joy, that has been inflicted on the Jews in the name of Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, how can we not know this? That is a book everybody should read, James Carroll's Constantine's Sword.
And I think religion is the problem. I mean, I'm not bashing religion either as far as a faith orient, but I am bashing religion as far as when you, I mean, this is going to sound like I'm anti-institution, a little bit, but
such a millennial.
But I will say, like, there is something that happens.
Are all millennials like this? Is that what y'all are saying?
A lot of us are. Well, it's interesting though. Actually, even thinking of generational differences, I mean, millennials grew up. You know, we've seen at least 10 things that I can name off of the top of my head of once in a lifetime historical events. You know what I'm saying? So there's some cynicism that is relevant in the millennial mind, right? Like I was in middle school when the first crash happened, I think, the 2008 crash, I think it was in middle school or early high school, you know, and think of how that like plays with your mind around thinking through what you believe about the government or what you believe about banks or what you believe about religion. Because of social media as well, I mean, there's so much news that is, you know, Muslims attacking people, Christians attacking people, Buddhists attacking people. Like, we just see large groups of institutionalized folks use that power. I think with institutions comes power, and with power comes corruption. And so I don't think the faith is the problem. I don't think the belief is the issue. I think that is what roots out that pain. That's what roots out that that violence. But when we get into conversations about large religion, I mean, there's just so much corruption there, and there's so much power there, and you know, it's hard to admit it, but if hanging somebody else will mean that I can get further, there are many that will do it in the name of whoever.
And we just saw that on January 6th. I mean, that very phenomenon, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So on that light and cheery note. Exactly.
I was born by the river in a little tan, oh, just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes, it will. And I go to the movies, and I go downtown. A long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I couldn't last for long. But now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long, a long time coming. Oh, the change won't come. It's been a long, a long time coming, but I know the change gon' come. It's been a long, a long time coming, but I know the change gon' come. 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 Change gon' come, a change gon' come. It's been a long, a long time coming, but I know a change gon' come.
You know, that song is basically, has been elevated basically to a hymn in the Black community. Mm. You can put that up alongside What a Friend We Have in Jesus or Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior, and you'll get the same reaction. And I think it's a testimony to the ways in which Black creatives and Black artists have hoped us and have given us language for what seems unmentionable, from a Sam Cooke to a Kirk Whalum, from Mother Cicely Tyson, God rest her soul, to an Amanda Gorman, we have been gifted words and wisdom and music and beats and rhythms that can hope us, even if it takes a long time. And I want to lift a familiar voice from amongst that canon, one Langston Hughes, as our meditation for this session. It's a familiar poem, and I was going to read a section of it, but I'm actually going to read the whole thing, Let America Be America Again, because I believe it provides an interesting dialogue to help mirror what we've been saying this afternoon. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America was never America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dream. Let it be that great strong land of love where kings never connive nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say who you are that mumbles in the dark, and who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways, of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker sold to the machine. I am the Negro servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean, hungry yet today despite the dream, beaten yet today. O pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead. The poorest worker battered through the years, yet I am the one who dreamt our basic dream. In the old world, while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turned, that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home, for I am the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lea, and torn from black Africa's strand, I came to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me, surely not me. The millions are in relief today, the millions shot down when we strike, the millions who have nothing for our pay, for all the dreams we've dreamed and all the songs we've sung and all the hopes we've held and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again. The land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where every man is free. The land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's live, we must take back our land again. America, oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we the people must redeem. The land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains and the endless plain, all the stretch of these great green states, and make America again.